Welcome everyone to the Partner Up Profits Podcast. I'm your host, Joey Viancor, a former introverted small towner who now adds value to businesses by sharing the most effective ways to grow and scale using affiliate and influencer partnership strategies. I'll share the lessons I've learned over the past 15 years while helping my clients generate more than 100 million in sales. We'll also dive into productivity hacks, mindset, and the newest trends from real case studies and expert interviews. You're just one partnership away from changing your business. So get ready, partner up, and profit. Let's get into it. Before we get into the episode, make sure to visit partnerupprofits.com to get access to my library of systems, tools, templates, and courses to help you and your teams level up in affiliate and influencer marketing strategies. The Bootstrapper's Guide to Influencer Marketing is the go-to resource for making sense of how to profitably start, build, and scale an influencer marketing program, and it's got over 2 hours of free video lessons along with a resource guide. And I'm constantly adding new things to make your life easier with plug-and-play tools and templates, and it doesn't stop at influencer marketing. So if you like done-for-you systems and free stuff, then be sure to go to partnerupprofits.com and join the community today. All right, Jesse, man, welcome to the Partner Up Profits podcast. I'm excited for you to be here today, so welcome.
Thank you. Really appreciate the opportunity to come on.
You've got a lot of interesting stats. What's something interesting about you that not many people might know?
Ooh, let's see. I grew up in a TV-free household until I went to college. My parents were not fans of TV. I caught up on all the movies and the shows in college, and I decided to make my career in advertising and media. So I took a real U-turn, but most people don't know I grew up with no TV in my house, and here I am selling ads on the internet.
What was like the first show that you started to watch when you discovered TV for the first time?
Oh my God. The first show, let's see. Well, it wasn't a show, but a movie we watched on repeat. So I'm dating myself a little bit. This is 2006 or so. I'm at college on repeat at every dorm room is Anchorman with all the quotes and, you know, seeing it 50 times. And that was the kind of environment for media at the time. But I also remember one of my first favorite, you know, web publishers, websites, remember Break.com, which I'm not sure if Break is still around, but they were kind of like the prank website at the time. And as a freshman in college, you know, the high speed dorm room access, internet access, watching prank videos and skits and stuff. It was like, wow, this is cool. This is the new SNL. And, you know, fell in love with the internet.
Dude, yeah, Anchorman was one of my favorites. What was the other one? Old School?
Yes.
It was all the same era of those movies.
Yep.
I mean, yeah, I remember dial-up internet, but I didn't have a cell phone until I was like 25 years old. Like literally didn't have it, didn't need it, didn't see it before. And then I got it and I was like, oh, what's this thing going to do? And then... things changed.
And now cell phones run our lives and they're our bosses.
As we will discover, there's some big powers with the cell phone we'll get into in this. But you mentioned some education, but like when you were little without a TV and everything, what did you really want to be when you grew up?
Oh man, I for most of my childhood, probably until I was, I don't know, 10 or 15, I wanted to be a vet. I wanted to, you know, work with animals. And now as an adult, I have a 80-pound German Shepherd, and she's an extra full-time job. So it's no longer my career aspiration of choice, but loved animals. And that was what I was interested in growing up.
Awesome. Did you have animals growing up?
I did. I had a lot of animals. We lived, actually, the house that my parents are still in, not really quite a rural area, but far enough outside of town that they had a couple acres. And we had chickens, we had a horse, we had a couple horses at one point, and tons of stuff to do outside and lots of chores, which maybe is, now that I'm thinking about it, the reason that we were TV free, there was enough stuff to do. But yeah, that was the environment growing up.
That's awesome. I didn't realize that. And I had a pet hotel and a bunch of horses and animals and things like that. And I actually have the reverse effect. Like I don't want pets now. I have like a committee. And they're expensive and they're finicky and they get hurt a lot, right? Like there's a lot of things. They're almost worse than a kid in a way, because like they just remain at the same intellect.
They never grow up. It's true. It's true.
The kids can be challenging too. So I moved on to kids now and I just don't want
to compound the effect.
Yeah.
But wait, let's not let this slide by. What is a pet hotel?
So it's like it's a boutique place for cats and dogs, animals to go whenever we're on vacation.
Amazing.
So they're on vacation.
Amazing. And this was a family business?
It was a business I ran with my previous wife, and we had a 30-acre pet hotel, ranch, equestrian facility.
Amazing.
Work, and to your point, like, there was no time for like TV. There was just like floors and employees and teams and things to do all the time. I'm done with that era in life. I like the laid back, no pet thing.
I feel you. Pros and cons.
I'm cell phone again.
yes. Fascinating.
So, I want to talk, because I was kind of reading through some of your bio today too, and I was like, you were in college in 2005, 2006. Like, when did you start to work in the industry?
I graduated in 2009 and I started in the industry in 2009. I was lucky enough to be paired up with an alumni from my college who was in the advertising field. I wanted to do something in advertising. I didn't really think much about the difference between creative advertising, brand advertising, advertising technology. And I happened to meet someone who is very generous with his time and, you know, kind of showed me the ropes for a couple of days at his job at what was then owned by AOL.com back when they were still a powerhouse, maybe towards the like waning ends of the AOL empire. This is like after the, you know, free CD in the mail type era, this is like after that, they had a company called advertising.com. which I think might be still around as a standalone entity. And I learned about ad impressions and some of the basics of display advertising, which was, you know, super important at the time, but was becoming increasingly important for traditional news publishers, especially as they moved to the, you know, the era of like internet first. And yeah, got my toes wet with ad tech and kind of never looked back. I've always loved understanding how everything works under the hood, and particularly from a kind of marketing infrastructure point of view.
Were you a fan of like infomercials from back in the day, like all the catchy jingles and everything like that?
It's really funny you asked that. I spent my day maybe like 2 weeks ago YouTube searching for some of the memorable kids TV ads that I would see when I was like over at a friend's house or my grandma's house or whatever. And maybe they were even more impactful because I didn't have a TV at home. But there was one in particular that there was like this kid's toy that was, it was like a zip line toy that you could, you know, operate as a kid and like shoot this, you know, crazy little vehicle across this string and pick up these basically like these little balls. And it was like, there's really no point to this device, except it was really fun. And it had the best ad of all time where you were, you know, you were like a general in charge of this crazy special operations, you know, combination between an airplane and a submarine. And it makes no sense. And it made no sense when I found it on YouTube, but boy, did it bring back memories.
That's awesome. I don't remember that. So you got to send it to me. I will
send you a link.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of that. And I think it'd be cool if they'd run a marketing campaign that like brought back mimicking ads that, you know, but you actually insert your own product into it, but make it into like the ad that somebody would remember from back in that era.
Yeah, for sure. Also, if, you know, for anyone that's listening, that's a fan of this stuff, there's a great episode of the podcast Planet of Money that is all about the 90s era of radio ads and a bunch of classics on there. And one which they cover extensively is the original Got Milk campaigns. And they touch on the milk mustache thing. But before that, there was a famous ad that had to do with like, you know, someone trying to answer a call-in show prize that was like an expert in history. Anyway, I don't remember the details, but that's a great episode. Check it out if you love advertising and advertising history.
I think they were geniuses before their times in a lot of ways, or just like, we'll never see their likes again in that capacity. But I do remember the milk commercials, and there was a guy, Doug Gilmore, hockey player. And I think he was one of the spokespeople for the milk commercials, and he had these skin tight pants on that were like, had kind of like leopard print, cow print type things. I was just like, oh man, I wonder how much he got paid for that thing. But But I mean, yeah, so we're off on a tangent. I really want to get into SMS marketing today.
You're
an expert. There's a lot to unpack in it. But walk me through, because you've led a couple, you know, big missions in your life, including $800 million in cumulative exits. You've worked for a few startups that had that. And then you worked with Google, which I think is fascinating. Anybody that's worked with like high, big tech companies like those or Facebook, et cetera. Just give us a brief background on what that looked like for you during those periods of your life.
Yeah. So I, straight out of school, joined a startup called AdMeld that was on the forefront of turning internet ads into kind of biddable, you know, a biddable environment. So imagine, you know, 2009, you fire up the web, you go to break.com to watch a prank video. If you get a display ad, there's a good chance that that had been a negotiated ad placement where someone had called up the website and had been like, hey, I want to place my ad for, you know, I don't know, Jeep on your homepage. How much is it going to cost me? There was a human back and forth. There was a negotiation. There was probably three martini lunch involved somewhere. And eventually the ad sale was made and it was bought up front. And, you know, Jeep owned, you know, a certain placement for a certain amount of time. In 2009, there was a whole bunch of companies that sprung up around making advertising exchange operated, meaning if you're an advertiser, you could, you know, plug into this massive feed of ad opportunities and place a bid. And this sounds like so basic because most of, you know, most of the internet advertising world is now built like this, from Meta to Google and, you know, a bunch of other places. But at the time, it was extremely novel to be able to do that on a third-party website and to say, hey, I only want to buy an ad spot if it's from someone that visited my website and looked at these, you know, this particular pair of shoes. So around that time, there's a bunch of novel, you know, advancements. One of them was called retargeting, which I'm sure many of the marketers listening know about. But the, you know, the grandma's experience was like to describe it as like the most basic understanding of what's happening. You know, you would go to a website, you'd look at a pair of shoes, you might not be interested in it. And at some point later, you're on a totally unrelated site, you see an ad for that pair of shoes. That stuff was not possible until, you know, until the kind of 2009 era. And it was a really exciting, you know, series of advancements. I was lucky enough to be part of two teams at two separate companies that, you know, really led the charge on making ads biddable and making the ad ecosystem into one giant exchange and free market in a way. And I did that at a company that was acquired by Google. And I spent some time at Google working on the DoubleClick ad exchange, which is still a major part of the Google ecosystem. And then at a company called LiveRail, which did similar stuff for video ads, which were also kind of on the cutting edge at the time in 2012 to 14 or so. Facebook bought LiveRail and got to work on a bunch of really cool stuff at Facebook for the next 6 or 7 years.
Nice. And it's interesting, like retargeting was so novel back then. I'm just wondering, like I have a question later regarding the retargeting that's kind of interesting, but you mentioned DoubleClick, Google DoubleClick advertising. What was that? I'm not familiar.
Yeah. So DoubleClick was a real innovator in the advertising space. It was one of the first networks and one of the first ad servers kind of rolled into one. It was bought by Google early on and it became the kind of undercarriage of the Google ad ecosystem. So as the Google, you know, ad opportunity became more than just search ads and actually turned into display ads, DoubleClick was a huge part of that, you know, that shift that enabled advertisers to say like, hey, I want to buy people that are searching for, you know, for my sneakers on Google. And then I also want to serve a display ad to them around the web. And Google made that possible in a way that was really innovative at the time and gave them a head start that actually, you know, still contributes in a big way to their business today.
Interesting. Now I get it. Thanks for kind of going through it. But it's like, it's, I don't know, it's so just like nostalgia thinking back to those days of 2009. That's kind of where I got my start too, like 2008, 2009. And all of this was brand new to me. It was like the wild, wild west with regards to like some things weren't even getting,
oh man,
like, you know, through some of the networks. And
totally.
There were so many things going on.
It was the wild, wild west.
And it's moving so much quicker these days, especially obviously with AI and everything coming out. But want to hear your take on a question that I always like to ask people is, where do you see businesses leaving money on the table? Like, where would be an instant low-hanging fruit that you'd walk into a business, do an audit, and be like, okay, here's how we're going to improve cash flow in this one area that you guys aren't even paying attention to?
So one of the things, like, I'll answer with stuff that I'm, you know, personally knowledgeable about and passionate about, which kind of comes out of my ad career, is there is an extreme level of dependence today for most brands. I'll narrow it down into brands in particular. Most brands, although this could apply to, like, you know, other things outside of brands, most brands are overly reliant on advertising and are at a real strategic disadvantage when it comes to ownership of their data. This isn't a new story, but, you know, it's kind of like an increasingly important one. As Google with their, you know, DoubleClick asset, and Meta with Instagram and their incredible ads platform, and now Amazon and TikTok have become, you know, really the dominant forces in advertising, they've delivered incredible results for businesses of all kinds, and especially brands, where, you know, you could spin up a D2C brand, you know, a few years back, just running ads on Facebook, right, and turn it into a huge success. You know, as that became known, obviously brands and businesses of all kinds leaned into these big platforms. And these platforms are kind of walled gardens in a way. You put targeting in, you get results, but you don't get, you know, a high level of fidelity around the data and ownership of data. So what do I mean by that? The biggest low-hanging fruit for many businesses is just making sure that you own your customer and prospect list, and that you're able to reach them on your own without relying on the walled gardens and the advertising machines. So one of the things we think a lot about at my company, High Tide, and with some of the projects I've worked on in the past, is, you know, how do you convert your customer and prospect lists into an owned channel that you have control over? And the best way to do that today is through email lists and SMS lists, not to replace advertising, because advertising is still kind of the core way that you can find people that are interested in your products or your business of any kind, but just make sure that you're converting people that are interested, or even people that are following you on social. Any opportunity you get, let's make sure we get their email, get their phone number and their consent to reach out to them directly, so you can control your own destiny and almost certainly drive better outcomes than if you're just relying on advertising alone.
Yeah. And you mentioned, like, email lists. I know that for, like, many companies, email is where the money's at. Like, you know, if you're not running lists, if you're not segmenting and just nurturing those lists. But I think, to your point, if you're not really owning the third party list, like, for example, Instagram, like, you're advertising through your profile, and maybe you're using influencers to advertise as well, but you're dependent on the platform. You're not extracting the info. You're not actually creating customers. Maybe you have a customer list, but as far as a leads list for retargeting and all these other options you have, if you're to acquire those leads, you have a lot more options, and you can build separate lists and build upon those. So I want to, because I don't really understand SMS marketing as much as I'd like to. Again, I'm kind of a late adopter, getting a cell phone when I was like 25. But I know how to monetize through partnerships. That's my specialty. But talk to me, like, if they're not experts in SMS marketing, what are some of the fundamentals that you've seen that have caused success for your clients, as far as, like, the difference between, like, email marketing versus SMS marketing?
Yeah. So email and SMS, as you can imagine, are often kind of complementary, where a brand, you know, again, thinking from a brand perspective, because those are most of my clients, a brand will use both, but they'll use them for different things. Email is, you know, very, very cheap. You can build a list. There's not a very high bar from a compliance or regulatory perspective for acquiring or sending an email. So you see a lot of innovation around reaching people's inboxes and, you know, pretty easy list growth overall. SMS, on the other hand, it's a much more personal channel. It can often feel like a private channel from a consumer standpoint. And that means that you're going to get less opt-in overall, but the people that opt into your text list are going to be much more likely to engage with content that you send them. So just to drop a stat, text messages have an average click-through rate that's about 8 times that of email. Email is great. Email is cheap. Email is an important part of any kind of, like, marketer tool belt. But for messages where you want to make sure you're reaching someone in their, you know, kind of most protected channel, the more that you can get consent and opt-in for sending texts, the better off you are. The last kind of stat to back this up that I found fascinating, I just actually came across this one recently, is if I think about how many email lists I'm signed up for, I do an okay job of scrubbing my inbox and unsubscribing to stuff I'm not really interested in. And it's kind of like better for both people. Like if there's a brand I'm not really interested in, I'll opt out. Maybe I'll come back to them later. I'm probably subscribed to, like, I don't know, 20 or 30 lists, which is like a lot, but not like a crazy amount. I definitely don't get through all of those emails. I scan subject lines. I open every once in a while. On the other hand, the average consumer, 95% of people are subscribed to 7 or less brands text list. So if you've won the opportunity to get a subscriber on your text list, you're really, you know, standing out from the crowd and outside of the noise. And that's why the performance overall is so much better. The last thing I wanted to add is, like, the responsibility is much higher too. You know, if you're sending annoying texts way too often with very little value and you're just sending a discount over and over and over again, you're going to lose people very quickly versus an email where you might sit in their inbox unopened, but there's not a huge push to unsubscribe.
Interesting. Yeah, I have a question on that. So let's talk about the marketing approach, email versus SMS. And you might say it's the exact same thing, but for us, what I noticed with some clients was, like, if they're coming from mobile, it has to be really mobile optimized. Now, you hope everything is, of course, but are there any other fundamentals that you'd recommend? Like, your SMS marketing should go to this specific lander with these elements, this wireframe, versus maybe someone on their email, their desktop, so they have a bigger screen, like just anything like that, nuances you've seen your clients implement?
Yeah. So the device that's coming onto the page is really important from a marketer standpoint. You hit the nail on the head there. There's a couple things that make texts, like opt-ins, unique and interesting. Firstly, any major text platform will have what they call a keyword subscribe. So as a consumer, you might be familiar with this. You see, like, hey, text 6797, the word, you know, concert to get the latest, you know, Live Nation tickets, just making up an example. If you're looking to join a text list from a brand on mobile, that subscribe action can be handled really nicely, either by just, like, tapping in your phone number and then hitting Y to confirm, or via what's called either a two-tap or a two-touch, where you're just, you know, pressing one button on the landing page that then pre-populates your text message, you know, app, whether that's iMessage or wherever else you send SMS or text messages from, with the keyword. So you then just have to hit send. And so all the kind of, like, hitch on the opt-in language and the TCPA compliance, which is, like, the legal requirements for what you have to tell a user to expect if they sign up to your list, all that stuff's handled ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And so the opt-in is really clean. But on the other hand, you do have to meet some really high bars when you're asking people to opt into your list, more so than email. So you have to make sure that they explicitly understand that they're signing up for your marketing list, that they should expect, you know, X number of texts per month, and, you know, supply privacy language, terms of service, a bunch of stuff. So that has to be handled delicately. And it all adds up to that, you know, getting a text opt-in or SMS opt-in is extremely valuable. The bar is high, both from a consumer, like, you know, perspective, I only want things I really care about in my text list, and also the regulatory side, it's really important that you hit the right checklist of concerns. Otherwise, you can get fined pretty dramatically and actually penalized and pay financial penalties.
And that's more true than ever before. I mean, the amount of compliance scrutiny happening these days, it's getting, like, especially, well, we work with supplements primarily, and you can imagine that there's a lot of scrutiny on that in itself. But in general, yeah, like, you know, having your T's crossed, your I's dotted, very important.
So important.
So walk me through how somebody might do this themselves, but then obviously, like, go high tide itself. How does this simplify the process for people? And I mean, I saw it, I reviewed the software, you gave me a great demo, and I instantly saw value, because it's like, we could probably do it ourselves. It'd be a lot of work and a lot of management, and I don't want to figure all this out. But I saw the opportunity. So walk us through just, like, what do you simplified in the process, and what does it look like from start to finish to get set up and to get going?
Yeah. Okay. So let me set the stage quickly. So the way that most brands are building their text list are through on-site pop-ups. So you, as a consumer, are familiar with this. You hit a page, you're browsing around. You either click X or maybe you put in your email, maybe you put in your phone number. Often these offers are discount-oriented. So if you're shopping and you're like, well, yeah, I want 10% off, let me throw my email address in there and get the code. Or, you know, I'd be happy to get text messages from this brand that I've been checking out for a long time. Let's see if I can get a discount. The percent of opt-ins that come from this pop-up, you know, typically at the end of the intent funnel or journey is really, really high. But also that, you know, the act of acquiring with a discount is very expensive. If you think about it from a margin perspective, you're giving 10% on purchase, you know, that can really, really add up. And, you know, even more so if you have a small margin. Our company is built around the premise that there are other ways you should grow your list in addition to pop-ups, and that the, you know, first and foremost, the place that you should build your text list is from your engaged followers on social. And so what we've built at High Tide is a unique tool that allows you to move engaged followers, meaning people that have commented on posts or that are DMing you, into very short direct message automations that ask them to subscribe to your text list. A functional example of that, that is kind of a common use case for High Tide, is if you're a brand that's, you know, selling, say you're selling a premium suitcase or luggage, you have 200,000 followers, you want to get as many of those followers moved into your owned channel as possible so you can reach them directly. That usually means SMS or email. Maybe you want to post a giveaway that's like, hey, we're dropping this new colorway of our suitcase. It's going to be available next week. We're actually giving three of these out to our followers. Tag a friend if you're interested in joining this giveaway. Or, the, you know, maybe the call to action is tag a friend if you want to be notified when the product drops. And what High Tide enables the brand to do is send a private direct message to the person that has commented on this post and basically take them through a very short subscribe journey that's like, hey, great, last step for joining this giveaway, or last step to get an alert when this product launches, what's your phone number? And, you know, asking for that phone number, then supplying the proper regulatory language and moving that person from Instagram DM into the SMS list, whether that's Klaviyo, Attentive, SendLane, or PostScript. And so what we've seen is really effective results because we're hitting people often higher in the funnel when they're, you know, maybe not ready to navigate to your LinkedIn bio and go over to your website and browse around and wait for that pop-up, but they're high intent enough that they're more than happy to give their phone number and marketing opt-in consent in exchange for something of value. So this is one of the first, you know, pushes that we've made to move, you know, convert social followers into SMS lists, and it's working really well.
How instantaneous is it? So you say like, engage on this post, drop a thumbs up emoji, and we're going to send you the next step. Happens right away. Do they get it right away?
Yep. Yep. Happens right away. So this is all done through Meta's messaging program. So they've provided tools for developers like High Tide to build on top of, and they have very clear rules. So that's something that's changed in the last couple of years. You used to be able to, you know, if you wanted to sign up for software that could do things like this, but none of it was authorized by Instagram and you're running very high risk for using tools like this. In the last year and a half, maybe 2 years now, Meta has done an incredible job of investing in two areas. One is creating the tools to allow you to send instant direct messages to your followers and create these messaging automations. And number two, like, define the rules. So I call this the rules and tools. The rules are very clear. You can send an automated message within 24 hours of a DM or a comment, and you have, you know, an interaction and a reply and sort of like a safe back and forth, but you can't do other things. Like, you can't, you know, message all your followers and kind of blast to them without getting their permission. So the good thing is this stuff has been defined enough that we could build software on top of it. And we happen to have taken the approach of wanting to invest in these SMS opt-ins because we know how powerful they are. And we know that there's a kind of a weak link right now between these big engaged social followings and SMS lists that brands control. So yeah, that's the how it came to be story.
Yeah, and you touched on the next question I was going to have was like compliancy. We've used some, you know, API integrations that then get deprecated. And I'm like, oh, we're stuck with this software now. But it sounds like you guys have the rules and tools in place. But the reason why I brought up the instantaneous DMs is like, if I go to a site and I put in my email and I'm going to still browse the site, I may or may not go check my thing right away because I may not be ready to go purchase, right?
Yep.
So I don't leave that email. It's in the laundry list.
Yeah.
And especially DMs. I'm not answering typically DMs all the time or messages all the time. However, if I expect it right away, I'm going to go check for it right away.
Yeah.
What I really like about the tool is that it's instantaneous to their DM. They're instructed like, hey, by the way, we're going to send you a message to follow up and continue this conversation. So you're creating the interaction between you and like the end user. And that will, in my mind, that's where I would actually want to go to my DMs. I'd go find you, make sure you don't get lost in the spam junk folder. But one other thing I wanted to ask was like, how many messages can you send? Yeah, I'm losing track of my original question, but yeah, is there a limit to how many messages you can send within these DMs? Because you said like what, one per 24 hours to like that one person?
Yeah, the way that the automations are structured is the user needs to respond in some way. So In our case, we are DMing someone, say that they have entered a giveaway, DM them, you know, from the brand in the brand's voice saying like, hey, thanks so much for your interest as, you know, the last step for either entering the giveaway or to complete your entry, sign up for a text list. What's your phone number? And so ending the first message as a question sets you up for a response. It's conversational. So it's like, you know, a pretty natural experience. Yeah. And then the user will reply with their phone number and, you know, more times than not, usually the conversions are, you know, on the low end, it's like in the 50s. On the high end, it's 90 plus that end up on the text list. And that's, you know, pretty astounding conversion rate. And, you know, we keep it short. Someone chops in their phone number. Okay. You know, they've gotten the consent language that they need, and then they can complete the subscribe and they end up getting the end kind of like subscriber message from the brand that says like, hey, cool, here's your, you know, discount code, or like, hey, great, we got you down for that drop alert. And that then comes through text message. And so, yeah, it's a clean experience. I love the way that the rules have been written by the Meta messaging team. And it's a really effective business tool.
Yeah. And the other thing that I like about it, beyond customer acquisition, you and I talked about the fact that we could leverage this to actually bring ambassadors into your, into your partnership program by saying like, hey, who has maybe, I mean, you could call people out. You could be like, who has $5,000 or more, you know, our ambassador programs open for application, drop an emoji here to apply. And then you can accept that as an automation. And we are exploring that. Like that's still on our roadmap for 2024, but it's so much more than just customer acquisition. I think it's just an action tool, right?
It's been really fun when we rolled the platform out about, I guess, 7-8 months ago, launched our first experience for brands. We had like 3 or 4 campaign ideas. We were like, all right, obviously this will work for giveaways, this will work for drop alerts. We've come up with like 10 or 12 that we recommend. And so brands have a kind of like a laundry list of, or a buffet of options to look through. And yeah, one of the more recent ones is this, you know, this ambassador one where, you know, we can trigger off any of our usual ways to start an automation, which includes DMs, comments. In my opinion, the best one for the influencer approach is story mentions. So we have the ability to send someone a DM if they mention you in their story. Mm-hmm. And so you could see something really natural, like, hey, you know, we're looking for, you know, let's see, photo contest. Imagine it's a pet brand. We're looking for, you know, our October pet ambassador, you know, post a picture of Fido and tag us, and we're going to pick one winner that's going to, you know, win a free, I don't know, leash, whatever. You get the picture. It's really cool because you can hit those people and then put them in a text list. And so you can then, you know, reach that segment. Say you captured 100 aspiring influencers. You can throw them on a text list, throw them in a segment in Postscript or Attentive or wherever else you do texting, and reach them directly in a way that they're, you know, much more likely to see and act upon.
Yeah. I mean, that was huge for me when I heard that, just based on like our team, what we work at. I was like my eyes lit up. I was like, okay, well, we got to use this for that tool.
Yeah.
Can you share some stats? Like obviously not giving any confidentiality things, but like what's the average bump email, like, you know, SMS marketing wise, what can people expect after working with a tool like this? I don't know if you want to give like numbers based on what their page follower is or like what kind of companies, but just average ballpark estimates of what this equates to in dollars.
Yeah, so when a brand launches with us, we like to measure success based on the percentage of their followers that are converted into text subscribers. And for brands that have, you know, big following size of, you know, 200K plus, usually in like the 200 to 1.5 million range, we aim to move somewhere between 2 to 5% of their following to text subscribers. And we see a success, you know, a kind of home run success if we can get, you know, 5% of the following overall to be added to your text list within a couple months and with a few campaigns. So rather than looking at it in terms of overall text list growth, we look at it as, hey, you have this big following that you can reach on a sporadic basis on Instagram. That's great. Keep using it. But let's get as many of those people signed up for the text list as possible. The final thing that I wanted to note is one of the cool things about our system is we are integration partners for the text platforms. So we have API access into Attentive and PostScript and Klaviyo and SendLane and a few more to come. And so we can provide some cool stats. Like we can say, hey, this campaign that you launched, you acquired 1,000 subscribers. 60% of those were net new. They've never been on your text list before. 10% of those used to be on your text list. They churned out at some point and now you've revived them. They're back, they're reactivated. And then, you know, the rest are currently on your list and now you have a new segment for them. So showing those stats also gives us a good read on health. And finally, for measuring success, after like the list growth question, the most important thing and kind of the ultimate goal of all this is to drive more revenue. So we have easy tools for showing the lists that you've built from Instagram and then mapping them to purchases. Shopify has a beautiful API that allows us on behalf of the brand to map those text lists into downstream purchases. So you're not just saying like, oh, great, I got more numbers. That's good. You know, usually that's the first step. You're then looking at like, okay, are those people actually purchasing? And what, you know, what's their average order value? How many of them are new customers versus existing customers? Stuff like that, that really allows you to measure the ROI of social in ways that were not previously easy or possible.
I love the transparency of all those different platforms and all those steps, because to your point, like if you can convert 2 to 5% of 200K following, that's awesome. And like, but what is the conversion rate then to dollars?
Exactly.
If you see that from start to finish, I mean, that's powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, I'm a fan, obviously. That's why I wanted to have you on the podcast.
Thank you.
Now, you mentioned you could do a little hookup for everyone listening to the podcast.
Yes.
So what does that look like and where can they go to find out more?
Yes. All right. So let me start with the latter first. So you can find us at gohightide.com. It's GOHITIDE.com. The company is called Hightide, HITIDE. And for any listeners that are interested in giving us a try, just mention the podcast and Joey, and I will, you know, number one, we'll give you a free campaign. You can try out the tool totally free. And number two, if you hit us up in the next couple months at least, I will personally, you know, take a look at your Instagram and come up with a few campaign ideas for you. We'll hop on a Zoom together and I can show you how to implement this for the best possible success. And so I would be really interested in you know, providing that deal to anyone that's listening.
That's awesome, man. But Jesse's a really smart guy. Obviously, if you're listening to the podcast, you know that already. But strategic-wise, I think you got a lot to offer. So that free audit's amazing. I appreciate the hookup there.
Thank you for the kind words, man. And right back at you. I appreciate it.
So we've ended the more formal part of the interview. Now we do a little bit of a personal, informal part. So the first question I have is, what's a Partner Up Profits power move that you've implemented? Now, this can be a connection strategy, a business move that's got your foot in the door, got the email answer, just something unique that got you noticed.
Oh man, I'm gonna go with one that may or may not be obvious. I live in New York. I'm lucky enough to be here in, you know, a city that sees a ton of, you know, startup activity. In particular, we have a really strong Shopify ecosystem, which is my personal kind of like niche of the world. I have found a lot of value in something that seems obvious, but is often hard to do, which is getting up from my desk, walking out of the apartment, showing up at a random meetup or a networking event that's, you know, relevant to my business and just talking about what I'm doing, describing some of the like stuff that we're doing in a non-salesy way, demonstrating my actual enthusiasm and what we do and what we're building in the world. And then just like listening to what people have to say in real life over a coffee or over a beer or whatever, you know, especially in our early stages where, as I mentioned, we're a little less than a year old here. It's critically important to just get out of the room and show up and meet people. And, you know, in this internet world, it's so easy to, you know, get used to the easy stuff. Emails, DMs, texts, all still really important. But my tried and true hack is like, I just show up as much as I can.
Yeah. Get out from in front of the camera, get in front of people.
Exactly.
Flex
exactly.
That muscle a bit. Yeah. I'm with you on
face to face.
Yeah. Nothing beats that. I've got 10 quick fire questions.
So oh, man.
The first thing that comes to mind, you can't think
okay.
about this. So easy one, first one, favorite food.
Favorite food, pizza, pepperoni.
Okay. Your best memory.
Best memory. Childhood vacations in Montauk before anybody else seemed to know about Montauk.
All right. If you had another go around and you have to write a new story for your life, what would it be in 30 seconds or less?
Oh, a new go around and another story. Well, we'd have to kind of tie it together with the intro combo, becoming a vet and working with animals. It's, you know, still love animals and maybe that's my alternative future.
Okay. I thought I was going to be becoming an actor and starting an anchorman. What's your best productivity hack you've implemented in your business or personal life?
I have a lot that I try to implement regularly. The one that I love right now, someone described for me the analogy of, you know, work and like creative output is like a garden hose in the summer, where when you first turn it on, all the crap comes out, the hot water, it's none of the good stuff. If you leave the hose running, after a while, you start to hit stride, you get that good cold water. There's a good at least 20 to 30 minutes of working on any particular project where it's painful, it sucks. I'm like, I don't want to be doing this. I want to be browsing LinkedIn feed, like doing something else, whatever. Got to push through that till the cold water comes out, and then you're kind of golden and you can, you know, keep going through your tasks and do your important task of the day. So yeah. That like push through thing is really important to me right now.
Interesting. I've never heard that, the way of looking at it, but I've experienced it. So I'm going to take that as inspiration. Now, this is a trick question. No, most of the people I talk to don't want to retire in the traditional sense, but what are you doing in your later years? What do you see yourself? What do you want to build towards in those like golden years?
Oh man. Well, from a professional standpoint, I would love to be in a business that has some sort of like real world output, you know, whether that's like a hospitality thing, a cafe, a restaurant, something where I can like show up and there's like tangible stuff to do and, you know, is, you know, getting away from the screen.
Really?
Would love to do something in the real world at some point. The second thing would be I love building stuff. My dad is a builder. He's in the, you know, construction and restoration business. So I grew up around tools and I would love to like build something cool one day, maybe like a badass treehouse or like a cool Airbnb on the side of a cliff. I don't know. I haven't come up with all the ideas yet, but that would be really fun.
That's all. I love that you said the real world too.
Like, yeah.
Like this world isn't real to us.
Oh man.
I've always wanted to build a house. I'm going to throw that out there. I don't think I'll ever get to do it, but I always wanted to build my own house. Like, you know, just everything, me, maybe some contractors to help, but like,
yeah, love it.
The dream I share with you.
You know, 20 years from now, hit me up. Maybe we'll have Jesse Construction Co. and we can make it happen.
Yeah, man. Have some casas somewhere across here or something. I'm looking at properties. What book changed your life?
What book changed my life? Good question.
I see a pile behind you. So
there's a pile behind me. Yeah. Let me not cheat. Let's see. Let me cheat. Okay. I'm turning around. I went against my word. All right. This is probably not a life-changing one. But this book I'm trying to pick a non like business self-help one because I got too many of those. This book from like overall, like trying to keep your head on in today's crazy world, Better Angels of Our Nature, Steven Pinker. Mm. It's all about kind of the progression of important like positive stats, you know, child mortality, violence, crime, all the things that kind of plague our societies. And when you turn on the TV, you can feel like, shit, things are getting worse every day. I mean, it's really hard to watch a lot of what's going on in the world. If you can, you know, read this book and read some stats as a way to balance out some of that negativity and try to keep in mind what human progress actually looks like when it's, you know, when it's positively manifesting itself in the world, it can help to balance out a lot of the negativity. So maybe not a life changer, but it's helped me a lot in, you know, keeping perspective in this 24-hour news cycle where there's a lot of really sad and infuriating things happening in the world.
Yeah, man, no, that's life changing in itself. It's perspective. So
for sure.
Based on that and based on the retirement question, do you see yourself being remembered for something? Like, do you want to be remembered for something?
Oh, man.
We're getting deep here.
What's that?
We're getting deep here.
We're getting real deep. I would like to, you know, at the end of the day, when my chapter is closed, I want to have really strong, deep connections with my family, both my, you know, my existing family and hopefully my future family. You know, part of what I want to do in the business world is in service of that goal. Some of it is, you know, obviously my own fire drive and ambition. But yeah, I'm big on family and I'd like to, you know, continue to make family an important part of my story. And, you know, who else is going to remember you at the end of the day, aside from your kids or your close friends or family?
Love it, man. Yeah, I agree with that. What's one skill you'd recommend developing as early on in life as possible to have maximum impact?
Let's see. It took me a while to learn this one. It wasn't until probably at least a few years into my career. Being comfortable with being rejected frequently. It sucks so much and it's so against human, you know, your instincts, especially if you care a lot about what people think about you. But being able to go out and ask for things or pitch people things mm-hmm. without feeling overly tied to the outcome. Like, you know, if you're going to ask for something, say you're going to pitch a customer, for example, obviously it's important. Obviously you want the outcome to be yes. But to be able to do that on a repeated basis while getting a lot of no's and being okay with that. And also at the same time, this is the key part, figuring out why you got that no, filing it away as, you know, kind of positive loop because you can make a change or make an improvement. That's huge. So like on the outside, it looks like being okay with rejection. At a slightly deeper level, it's, you know, both being okay with it and then taking something to learn from it. And just know that if you want to be successful, you're going to have, you know, more times than not people saying no, you know, not wanting to move forward with your idea, you know, quitting your company, you know, or worse. And this stuff happens when you try to build a business and interact with hundreds of people. There's just going to be a lot of no's, but they'll get you closer to that yes. So that's a huge one for me.
Yeah, that's probably one of the most creative answers I got on that question so far. And like objectively analyzing what happened without taking it at heart, you know, like personally holding that.
It's heart. Tough. I mean, I know you care a lot about your craft. I care a lot about my craft and what I do. Like, you know, it's tough, you know, to throw something out there, but if you don't, you're never going to make any progress.
And if you can learn that early in life, like the older I get, the less I care in a lot of ways. Just because
yeah.
Care. I mean, everyone does care. You're lying to yourself. You don't care what people think. But I think just like, yeah, if I could teach my kid that at like 10 years old or even earlier, I mean, man, he'd be much more set in life than I was because I didn't learn that till much later.
Well said.
Okay. We're meeting up in New York in a year from today. What are you working on that we're celebrating the accomplishment of you getting that done?
Oh, man. So we're meeting up a year from now. We will have built a in-person office for High Tide where we have a bunch of people that are super passionate about helping brands and Shopify brands succeed. And we will have expanded from being focused solely on SMS to now having a platform that helps brands collect zero-party data and marketing opt-ins of all kinds. And we're going to have a really exciting business being built here.
All right, man. We set the intention today.
Let's do it.
I'm going to hit you up in a year from now.
Here's your official invite. I can't give you the address yet, but here's to hoping it happens.
TBD. I'm sure it will. What's one last question? What's one bucket list item that you want to do, or just a new chapter that you still want to write in your life?
Oh, man. Well, this one's not too exciting, but I would like to at some point get caught up on all the reading that I want to do. You saw the books behind me. I love and I hate my phone. I love and I hate my email. It's a necessary evil, and it's a really effective way to build a business on all these, you know, these devices. But I also know that it's really important to unplug. So I'm going to take at some point in the future, take like a, you know, at least a couple weeks to just like read and absorb a whole bunch of ideas that I've been interested in that I haven't been able to dig deep into, and, you know, kind of broaden my mind from the day to day. So that's something I'm really excited for. It's maybe not exciting enough to hit the bucket list criteria of, I don't know, climbing Everest, but right now where I'm at with this startup, that is a great place to aspire to. And yeah, that's my answer.
That's okay. There's no right or wrong here. It's just what's on the horizon. So
yeah.
Either way, and I like it too, man. I'd love to have a reading week or just something where I'm just completely going all in on my book collection that I want to get to and learn. You know, there's just no time these days. But
yeah, it's a luxury.
Yeah. Jesse, great having you on the podcast. Everyone listening, check out gohightide.com. Get the hookup while Jesse's still available and giving the hookup. Get a free audit, get a free demo, and everything else that you guys are going to get from this, as well as I'm looking forward to next year with all the new integrations you guys are making. That sounded really cool, and I'd love to have a whole other podcast episode on that when that happens.
Let's do it. Huge fan of the pod. Thank you for all the knowledge you drop on a consistent basis, and thank you for a fun chat. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Jesse. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll catch you on the next one. Take care.
That's all we've got for this Partner Up Profits podcast episode. As always, I hope you leave here today with one new idea that you can apply to your life and business. I'd be forever grateful to you for leaving a review of this episode. And if you like it, rate it a 5 or give it a thumbs up and just leave a quick comment in iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you tune in to listen. Also, make sure to link up with us at partnerupprofits.com on social media. And please just share this podcast with anyone who you think might enjoy it. Until next time, remember, you're just one partnership away from changing your business. Let others do the selling for you and get ready to partner up and profit.